And the topic for tonight is journalism in the age of algorithms. Claire Lehman, thank you.
Thanks, Jared. Thank you, Jared. And thanks to you all for coming tonight. I know it's a balmy evening. And does that sound okay? I'll try and talk a little bit more loudly than I usually do. All right. So about a decade ago, I noticed a problem affecting journalism. Leading broadsheet newspapers were starting to publish a type of journalism that was of a lower quality than they had traditionally done so, from my perspective. It wasn't immediately clear what the reasons were for this, but it was my suspicion that the internet had something to do with it. This low-quality journalism was typified by online verticals such as Fairfax's Daily Life, I don't know if any of you remember that one, and American platforms such as Gawker and Jezebel. Some headlines from these platforms included, "I look down on young women with husbands and kids and I'm not sorry." And another article was titled, "How accepting leggings as pants made me a better feminist." I never intended to become a journalist and I never intended to work in the media. In 2015, I was training to become a forensic psychologist. But articles like the ones I just read out aggravated me so much that I started writing about them. I created a blog and wrote articles which debunked the facile arguments that they were making. But some point along the way, I realised that I wasn't actually arguing against a set of ideas at all. I was arguing against the business model. I realised that the publishers of this low-quality content were not producing journalism as it is traditionally defined. They were in the advertising delivery business. When a publication relies on advertising revenue, it doesn't matter if a piece goes viral because people hate it. It doesn't matter if a piece goes viral because everyone is outraged by it. The revenue accrues regardless. In this business model, quality, which is more expensive to produce, becomes a liability. In the mid-2010s, the big platforms such as Google and Facebook changed the editorial direction of newspapers. Because the architecture of these platforms reward content that is hyper-emotional, anger-inducing, and demeaning of out-groups, content that serves these functions tends to do better. And because platforms reward this type of content, publishers are incentivized to produce more of it. This is not simply an intuition. Data support this view. A study published in October last year, led by a New Zealand team, found that headlines denoting anger, fear, disgust, and sadness have all been increasing over the past 20 years, whereas joy and neutrality have been decreasing. The team looked at 23 million headlines from 47 news outlets only in the United States, so that's a caveat to the generalizability of the study. They analyzed them for an emotional payload across a 20-year period and found that headlines denoting anger had increased 104%, fear increased 150%, disgust increased 29%, and sadness increased 54%. Headlines that denoted neutral emotional content decreased by around 30%, and headlines denoting joy also decreased. And these trends were found to be bipartisan. They were similar in left-leaning outlets and right-leaning outlets. And the authors of the study found that although these trends existed prior to the advent of social media had intensified them. There was an inflection point around the year 2010. Now, what happened in the year 2009? Facebook introduced the like button and Twitter introduced the retweet button. they introduce virality into the information ecosystem. Now, someone who founded a much larger and more successful media company than I did in the mid-2010s recently reflected on what he learned from becoming a publisher in this environment. The co-founder of Vox Media, Matthew Iglesias, explained the dilemma faced by publishers. To do well on Facebook or Google, he writes, meant bending the editorial vision of the company. He said, people to this day underrate the influence of these companies on the structural properties of the content you consume. Everyone complains about having to read through a few hundred words before getting to a recipe that you want. Well, this is because Google gave priority to recipe pages that were structured like real articles. Then there was the time when big news organizations were structuring lots of stuff as live blogs because Google was giving priority to live blogs. The problem with trying to earn money through online advertising is that each ad impression is worth so little that you need to get millions and millions of impressions to make significant money. To receive millions and millions of impressions means that one has to conform to the parameters of the platforms that distribute content. You have to have the right link, you have to have the right thumbnail, you have to have the right headline. Iglesias observed that the dependence on these platforms became editorially constraining. He writes, the huge shift in media sensibility that happened during this time was absolutely not what editors and senior figures in the industry wanted to see. Even in retrospect, I don't really understand why this was the case, but objectively speaking, hardcore identity politics and simplistic socialism performed incredibly well on Facebook during this period. That doesn't mean journalists started pretending to be left-wing in order to get clicks, but people who had some authentic left-wing opinions found that writing on these subjects, where they were the most left, tended to generate the most traffic. Early career journalists with authentic leftist views outperformed their colleagues. So you ended up with this whole cohort of discourse structured around, is Bernie Sanders perfect in every way, or is it problematic to vote for a white man, as the only possible lens for examining American politics and society? This shift in sensibility in the media was alarming because it suddenly called into question the leadership of editors and publishers. Why were they allowing such poor quality content to be published? Did they not care about their brands? Did they not care about the reputation of their profession? All of these questions are valid and legitimate to raise in response to poor quality journalism optimized for advertising revenue. But as Iglesias explains in his reflection, the reason this happened was because the editors and publishers had been usurped by Facebook and Google. Quillette was founded in 2015 as a counterbalance to these dysfunctional trends. I wanted to create a space where thoughtful, longer form commentary that was analytic rather than emotional and sober rather than sensationalistic could be published. At first, I was incredibly excited by new media. The internet made it possible for new entrepreneurs like myself to start publications from scratch with very little upfront capital. And by very little, I mean very little. You can register a domain name for $20 and you can set up social media accounts for free. Unlike in the past when legacy media organizations had a monopoly on distribution, the internet and social media platforms created an environment where a thousand flowers could bloom. In 2018 and 2019, just a few years after founding Quillette, we were getting 3 million page views a month. One big data analysis found that we were the 14th most influential website in Australia, measured by how many international sites were linking to us. Our articles didn't necessarily go viral. But we published a high volume of essays that grappled with problems that larger legacy media institutions seemed too timid to touch. We criticized hardcore identity politics just as it was ascendant in mainstream media. We scrutinized anti-scientific philosophies prevalent in the academy. We raised alarm bells around gender interventions in children without the proper evidence base. We drew attention to cancel culture and the excesses of social justice activism long before the terms woke or cancel culture had become well known. We published well-respected academics and intellectuals that for one reason or another were not welcomed into the mainstream. All of this gave us an international reputation. But looking back, I think I was perhaps a little too idealistic about the promise of new media, at least new media that is freely available. The incentives that drive new media are exactly the same as the incentives that drove traditional media to embrace low-quality rage bait. And over the years, sadly, I have watched as peers and colleagues in the new media have become more angry, more partisan, more emotional, and less analytical. It's not hard to see why. When your angriest YouTube videos are the ones that go viral, it makes sense to keep producing more. I remember the first time I heard the term attention economy. I found the term repulsive. But unfortunately, this description is painfully accurate. What we have on our algorithmic social media platforms is not a marketplace of ideas. It's not the public square. They are gladiatorial arenas where people fight over who is granted the most attention. Like the media platforms I described earlier, these platforms are also in the advertising delivery business. We are saturated with content. It doesn't matter how niche your interests are, whatever you're interested in, the internet has something for you. In many ways, this is fantastic. If I like nature photography, I can connect with people all over the world who share my interests. I can join chat rooms, forums, see photographs on social media, on Instagram, watch videos about how to improve my own photography on YouTube. But when it comes to politics, the endless amounts of content mean that political commentators must compete with each other for attention. And to win this competition, one must appeal to the most primal aspects of human psychology. What do I mean by this? Well, think about it. For most of our history, we lived in small communities and tribes. We were often threatened by neighboring tribes. Those who alerted us to threats, especially threats from alien tribes, were highly valued. It paid to be alert to threats. It paid to be constantly scanning our environment for pernicious threats. Over the years, I have observed that people who are addicted to social media live in a constant state of anxiety. They are constantly scanning their environment for threats. And popular new media personalities fulfill a role where they constantly alert their audiences to potential threats, either to themselves or to their in-group status. I went on social media today and I found that the tweets that were going viral were about hyperinflation in the United States and the collapse of the US dollar, which someone was predicting was going to happen in the next 90 days. During the pandemic, Americans were hyperventilating over apparent concentration camps being built in Australia. Every day, there is a new panic, a new calamity. There is a new reason to get worked into a frenzy. Now, this is not partisan. Different flavors of doomerism are promoted by activists, journalists, and political commentators of all persuasions. The left's doomerism manifests in fears about a climate apocalypse, whereas segments of the right, particularly in the United States, indulge in paranoid fantasies about totalitarian world governments. It's easy to get sucked into this information ecosystem and to let its dynamics dictate what you spend your time writing about or reporting on. But I believe this is a mistake. A journalist's primary responsibility is not to spread alarm, panic, or endless stories of impending doom, no matter how popular this style of content is or how much revenue it brings in. A journalist's primary responsibility is to fairness and accuracy and the ethics of the profession. Social media engagement and commercial success must always be a secondary concern. The problem I have observed for many in the new media, independent media, is that when you are in the new media, you are both a journalist and an entrepreneur. These two roles are in conflict. This conflict can be managed, but far too many pretend it doesn't exist, that the conflict doesn't exist. So I hope I've convinced you that the internet has created some corrupting incentives on journalism. But I'd like to also reassure you that it has created new opportunities. Somewhat ironically, the most promising innovation in terms of journalism's future has been one that has returned the business model to the past. This model is the model of subscription. The path back to sanity for journalists is to make each audience member valuable. And you do that by charging audience members to read. In increasing the value of each individual reader, the perverse incentives created by the advertising business model are neutralized. It took me some time to learn as a publisher that revenue does not necessarily correlate with traffic. These two metrics can be completely decoupled. One can create a sustainable and thriving business that is self-generating without even looking at traffic statistics, which is what I do today. And I'm not the only one. Newsletter platforms such as Ghost and Substack, which you may have heard of, allow specialists to reach niche audiences who are happy to pay good money to support niche or specialist journalism. These past few weeks, I've been reading newsletter after newsletter written by finance specialists about the collapse of banks in the United States and now in Switzerland. And I've been reflecting that the potential for the public to read deeply on complex topics is probably unparalleled. The beauty of specialist journalism is that there's no word length, and experts can be more technical than they otherwise would be in mainstream newspapers or in magazines. The subscription model, I don't think, has really taken off in Australia yet, but the opportunity is there. Regional journalists covering local issues would benefit from establishing subscription newsletters. Journalists covering technical subjects or special interest cultural topics that are too niche for our largest newspapers would benefit from creating small publications like I have that pool talent and resources. The beauty of the subscription model is that one doesn't have to reach a mass market in order to create a viable business. In fact, the more niche the subject matter is, the more subscribers want to pay for it because they know the material cannot be found elsewhere. What is also encouraging is that the journalists who are doing very well with paid newsletters are not necessarily the ones who are going viral on Twitter with doomerism or outrage. There's Letters from an American is a newsletter created by a history professor in Boston. She looks at contemporary issues in American politics from a historical lens. She earns over $5 million a year in subscriptions alone. Other journalists who are earning close to $1 million or just under $1 million a year include Matt Taibbi, formerly of The Rolling Stone, Barry Weiss, formerly of The New York Times, Matthew Iglesias, formerly of Vox, and Andrew Sullivan, formerly of New York Magazine. Now, not everyone can earn $1 million per year, but it's pleasantly surprising just how much you can earn once you start charging readers to read your content. In Australia, News Corp recently surpassed 1 million paid subscribers, which I think is an astonishing milestone. More and more Australians are paying to access their news. I think at the moment about 18% of Australians have a paid subscription to a news online news organisation. It's not bad. So I think there are many reasons to be optimistic about journalism. There appears to be no shortage of good material to read. In fact, my main concern is not having enough time to read it all. The upside of the subscription model is that journalism is thriving, but the downside is that quality information is now somewhat of a luxury good. I say somewhat because subscriptions aren't hugely expensive, but there's always going to be a segment of the population who cannot afford to or is unwilling to pay. And this information inequality will exacerbate other forms of inequality. And while there's no shortage of good material, there's also no shortage of garbage. And the volume of this garbage is going to intensify thanks to artificial intelligence. At the same time, however, as the volume of malicious and fake content ramps up, discerning audiences will come to rely on trusted brands and individuals who have a track record of authenticity and creditworthiness. In some ways, I think we are actually entering into a new golden age of journalism, but this has only occurred because journalism has de-linked from social media. While social media still drives traffic to paid newsletters and online websites, these organisations are not dependent on social media for revenue. The more that news organisations can skirt around social media altogether, the healthier our information ecosystem will become. Ultimately, the only way to win the social media engagement game is not to play. Thank you.
Well, Claire Lehman, thanks very much for the talk. There are copies of the book around today, which Claire and others have edited, and she has a contribution in it. Panics and Persecutions, 20 Towers of Excommunication in the Digital Age. And there are copies outside. I'm sure Claire would be happy to sign one after. And now we come to, I should say, congratulations on your great success over the last decade. It's been quite extraordinary. So let's come back here and we'll start off questions and discussion. So you've been obviously very successful online, but in recent times you've gone into a print newspaper, which is also online, The Australian. So why did you make that choice? Why did you move? Because you probably had offers before then. And how important is The Australian contribution compared with what you do online?
Yeah, well, one reason why I accepted the offer from The Australian is because, unfortunately, Colette is not as well known in Australia as we're more widely known overseas than we are here. So when I go to America, I get invited onto CNN, and like I have many offers from Fox News and other TV shows. I don't get invited onto the ABC here in Australia. So I have a bit of a issue with breaking into the Australian market, even though I'm Australian. But writing for The Australian has helped me build my Australian audience more, and it is growing, which is lovely to see. And the other reason I like The Australian is because I think it's a very good publication, and I like the shorter op-ed format. So I edit longer art. We publish mostly long-form commentary at Colette, and it's much easier for me to write an 800-word op-ed than it is to write a 2,500-word article. I mean, it would take long. I can write an op-ed in half a day, and so it's not a big imposition on my time, and it's quite fun.
So just before you go on to the next question, what, you've never been asked on the ABC, you're occasionally asked because you're a high-profile Australian?
I've been on once on Q&A, but I've never been asked onto The Drum or anything like that, yeah.
Join the club. Where are we going now?
There's a question here.
Hi. Thank you. Claire, you mentioned, Gerard mentioned that you're training as a psychologist. So yeah. Can I ask you a question a little bit in relation to that? Mm-hmm. You talked about the role of emotion and drama and the direction of that's got, the media has gone in that regard. I'm wondering what you think about, is it Matthew Desmet's theory about mass formation psychosis in the community today? Because there definitely is what is commonly called fear porn today.
Yeah, I'm not that familiar with the theory, and I wouldn't agree. There, I mean, we have terms for conformity. So after World War II, there were lots of social psychology experiments that demonstrated how pervasive social conformity is, and I don't think confusing conformity with psychosis, which is something else entirely, is scientifically correct. So I would disagree with the terminology mass formation psychosis, and I would personally just use the term conformity to describe what he's trying to describe.
Right, so just before I do, we're having some slight problems on Zoom, but when it all goes out on audio later on, it'll be fine, yeah. Christian, here.
Hi. So where I see the major problem that's underlying everything is technology is growing exponentially, but the humanities are not. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be there's a pattern that about every 80 years, which comes from a theory of the fourth turning, Neil Strauss and... I can't remember. But essentially saying that because technology gets so far ahead of us, everything from the non-profits, the governments, the law institutions, everything can't cope, and then everything breaks down, and then there's some sort of crisis. Now, my question is, crisis moment was World War II, and then we created the Bretton Woods institutions, the UN, all these wonderful institutions. We're really at the ending point. Everything's going crazy at the same time, and it's probably going to take another 20 years. My question is, where do you see journalism in 20 years' time when this should all settle with the new technologies that are coming in?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think I'm both pessimistic and optimistic. So with any new information technology, chaos ensues. So when the printing press emerged in Europe, huge amounts of chaos came about, and it took a while for that chaos to settle down. But out of the chaos, we got the scientific revolution. We're just living through another time of destabilization, and I think we are a problem-solving species, and we will work it out. And I think, I can't give a prediction about where we'll be in 20 years, but I think if you look at history, we do have a way of solving problems and getting through times of chaos, and I think we will again.
Claire, one of the things that is really a big problem with social media and what the internet has made available is the fact that so much of the commentary is anonymous. Mm-hmm. In other words, the responsibility of a publisher doesn't lie on the shoulders of these people who have most of the bile and hate that is there. What I can't understand is why it couldn't be so simple as this, that in a way we all have to have a register, details that really tie us to our telephone and our home. Why couldn't the same sort of things that banks require be made a prerequisite for having an internet, Facebook, Twitter, or whatever account? And on the basis of doing that, then while it could remain anonymous, if there's defamation, if there is a breach in the sort of publishing law that regular publishers are required to comply with, mm-hmm. you would solve the problem. Mm-hmm. But, okay?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And the issue is that these companies are in the advertising delivery business. So what that means is they just want to juice the stats. They want there to be as many users. They want there to be, so Facebook has something like 3 billion users or something, right? And they encourage kids under the legal age of 13 to open accounts. They encourage, so I have an account that's got over 10,000 followers on Instagram. I constantly get a notification coming up saying, open another account to be closer to your friends and family. So that's simply because they do that so they can go to advertisers and say, you can reach 3 billion people on our platform. They don't have, their client is not us, the users of the platform. Their client is advertisers. And for as long as that business model continues, they won't verify users.
The governments can money them.
Yeah, but the American government doesn't regulate big corporations very effectively. So it might be up to us, maybe, hopefully.
Claire, I followed you for a while, so congratulations on your success.
Thanks.
If you look at, you talked before about the attention economy, but then, so there was a whole conversation about, you know, Twitter being 128 characters and nobody wants to think about anything more than about 30 seconds. But then Quillette's been very successful and it takes way more than 30 seconds to read anything there.
Yeah.
And you could look at Joe Rogan too. So how do you see those sort of different sides competing? And I guess, you know, where does the winner come out? Because I think the advertising model is against kind of watching things for a while, but clearly things are winning there as well.
That's a really good point. And that ties into my secondary thesis, which is that we're experiencing a golden age. And you'll find that there are it's not just Joe Rogan, but there are lots of very good podcasts that do very well, and it's a different medium compared to the clips or the tweets, the extremely short attention span pieces of content. And so there is a hunger for more substantial, meaningful content. And so, you know, we can be successful. And the success of Quillette is a testament to that. That is a hunger. I mean, it might not be as influential as we'd like, although Joe Rogan is very influential, but there definitely is an audience receptivity to more substantial content, for sure.
Claire, thank you. All very good. This, what would you call it? I call it the free-range information age.
Yep.
People like chickens scratching for where they want to find their particular kind of nurturing. How much has this been the reason we've all become sorted out into our own particular club mindset? So you'll have the ABC viewers over there and the Quillette viewers over here. And so we've all gone into new kinds of tribes. Mm-hmm. How do you see this panning out? Because it has made society rather sectarian or segmented.
Yeah, the splintering is very real. Unfortunately, I don't have a solution, and I'm not sure we'll ever go back to a time where we are not splintered. I think that's just a result of what the internet has done to us, and I don't think there's any way we can put the genie back into the bottle. I think we underestimate the profound changes that are happening to society because of the internet and because of social media, and I'm surprised there isn't more attention. I think it's the biggest issue of the time. I don't think we can ever go back, unfortunately. I would like to, but and I can remember a time before the internet. I'm old enough.
I'm just wondering, I'm interested to know about as a writer, you know, because you are, what is your psychological mind when you write a piece, like, you know, because, you know, the commercial newspaper is about a number of views, but also independent is about how many people subscribe your work. So what I'm saying, if you when you write, if that's your first concern, then how you can remain the independent of your intellectual integrity? because you got to write something in order to reach the maximum number of readers. Thank you.
Well, I don't write to reach the maximum amount of readers, and I don't think I ever have. I write for myself, and if other people want to read it, that's great. And I think all good journalists and good writers should write for themselves first and foremost. If you get an audience, that's a bonus. You cannot be a slave to any audience, real or imagined.
Tell us, there's a question down the back.
Yeah, you were saying earlier that there was a real hunger for some news in depth, mm-hmm. but would you like to segment that in terms of the age of the population? I mean, the millennials appear not to, which you probably are one, appear not to want to see anything in depth at all. They kind of like to go with the vibe. And this is really illustrated well when we were talking to some people from the Liberal Party a few months ago about why they lost the election. They said, well, why didn't you push these various objects about net zero problems, et cetera? They said nobody wanted the technical thing. They just wanted the vibe. And it's the older people, of course. But I was just wondering, in your feeling and in your work, do you feel this hunger amongst the millennials themselves?
Yeah, our age distribution is pretty spread across the board. We've got, I think our largest audience segment is between 25 and 35, but not under 25. So we're not big with the Generation Z, the Zoomers, who I think are increasingly getting their news from TikTok. So I wouldn't dismiss people in their 30s or their late 20s so quickly, but, you know, teenagers have always been a iffy market. I mean, they're not interested in the news. They've got other things to do, like party. So maybe they'll get into the news later.
So when you weren't doing parties, why did you decide and how did you decide to set up Quillette?
Well, I was, I think, 30 when I set it up. And so I would be the typical, I mean, I suppose I was definitely interested in ideas, but as a teenager and a uni student, I was reading books. I wasn't so much reading newspapers and commentary. Mm.
Then why did you do it?
Well, I explained in the talk that I was very aggravated by some of the stuff that was being produced by the Sydney Morning Herald. There was a vertical called Daily Life, and I used to read it, and it just made me very angry. So I started a blog to counter it, and it just turned out that I knew people who had interesting ideas, and so I thought I'd start a website, and that's how it happened.
Yes, we used to read the Sydney Morning Herald. What was it called?
Daily Life.
Daily Life, a media watchdog blog. It was good fun and deeply resented when they pulled it and stopped it. We need those sort of things.
Well, maybe.
We do.
Well, without it, we wouldn't have Quillette.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah.
Claire, thank you. Given your last comment and Gerard's last question, how would you relate, do you think the Australian education system has got any place to play, given they've had one generation, probably two generations or so, who have been subject to the slowly encroaching influence of social media and the internet and everything else? Would you be optimistic that an awful lot of young people, probably more than we realise, have got your mentality and wanting to, regardless of everything else, go out and seek the truth and the facts, etc.?
Yeah, I'm ambivalent about those issues because I'm fully aware of the dysfunction of certain academic departments and the bias and the groupthink in academia. I'm very well aware of that. At the same time, I think young people have agency and they're not all going to be brainwashed. And certainly people entering into degrees in the activist departments, degrees in you know, the humanities subjects are in decline. People who are going to university are choosing harder subjects these days, like science, STEM subjects. I think young people today have other concerns about cost of living, how they're going to buy a house in our current environment. I think to the extent that they're ideological, they're not as coloured by the social justice critical theory as some of the people in my bracket have been. I see younger people as being much more interested in material economic concerns.
Tell us a bit about your book. I mean, you've written the final chapter here, but you're pretty familiar with much of the stuff as the editor. I mean, some of the people here we know. Toby Young's in it, I see. So what are the kind of case studies? You've got a terrific endorsement from Neil Ferguson, which is stunning on the back page. But what are the message of these 20 or 20 plus people saying in here?
Yeah, so that book is a collection of essays mostly about cancel culture. After we established, we were getting essays from people who were being excommunicated or cancelled from artistic and academic communities, so academics, conservative academics, or artists who were maybe left-wing but not hard left, were being ousted from their communities. And at the time, there was a bewilderment as to why this was happening. Why were people being shunned by their peers and their colleagues? And we know now that we know about purity spirals that are sort of accelerated or catalyzed by social media mobs. We know now the dynamics. But when we first started publishing about these incidents, it was a brand new thing. So we started publishing about cancel culture 7 years ago. Nobody had the term cancel culture. We didn't know that social media mobbings were a thing, and we just provided a space for people to talk about what had happened to them. So in that book, we've got people being kicked out of theatre groups that they had established because they maybe questioned transgender activism. One gay playwright was kicked out of a Facebook group because he questioned something to do with drag queens reading for kids. But it's not all left-wing cancel culture. There are some instances of ideological groups mobbing for other reasons, but we focused most on the artistic and academic communities where this was ramping up over the last few years.
Claire, thank you. You started off by talking about decrying the lack of quality journalism and the increase of what I would describe as bile in a whole number of commentators. And quality journalism, one of the key parts of it has been having a sort of diversity of respectful, authoritative commentators who've grown their lives up through quality journalism. So, you know, I think of the Paul Kellys, for example, who are getting a little long in the tooth now. Are we growing young journalists in quality? Are there enough of people like you, for example, who've recognised that it's not about the maximum number of people reading you, it's about the quality that you're providing in the right sort of environment? Is that going to be happening so we've got those people in 20 years' time?
Yeah, that's really important question, and probably we're not cultivating new talent as much as we should be, and that's simply because of a lack of resources. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff out there, but you often find it's people working alone. And for young people, they really need to be mentored by senior people in their profession, like apprentices. And I don't work in The Australian at a news desk, but I know with working from home and people exiting the office, there's probably going to be less contact between junior journalists and seniors, and which will be to their detriment because you really do need mentorship to master a profession. So my intuition would be probably not, but yeah, we should be.
Claire, I'm not optimistic regarding journalism because I think the standard's gone down. I think in the days when they had cadet journalists, the standard was far higher.
Mm.
Like the ABC and that, everything I believe in, they just abuse people like me. So I've given them away, I've given Fairfax away. And the only areas where I get serious news is on Sky, The Spectator magazine and The Australian, because they have quality writers and they're believable and they check their facts, which a lot of the new ones certainly do not.
Yeah. Well, one of the worst things that's happened to journalism, particularly in the United States, is only hiring people with a degree. So with the cadetship stream, you had people coming straight out of high school going in to learn the trade as a trade and learning from senior people in the profession. Requiring people to go to university, I think, is a mistake, and you don't need... I mean, you need a certain level of intelligence, perhaps, but you certainly don't need a degree to be able to do journalism. You need to learn from the masters to learn the skills of the trade.
William. Yes, so could I press the issue of the origins of cancel culture a bit more? I mean, it sort of coincides with social media, I know. But from your interesting remarks over the past 40 minutes, I haven't yet got much takeaway as to why it is that cancel culture has erupted?
Well, I think cancel culture arises in any ideological monoculture. And so whenever you get a community of people who all believe the same thing, they're going to punish and excommunicate dissenters or heretics. And this happens in all sorts of ideological monocultures. Cancel culture is very prevalent in academia because almost all academics are left-wing. And people with classical liberal or right-wing views just select out of the university system. They don't go into postgraduate study. They don't see academia as a viable future career. But cancel culture can exist in other communities as well. It's not just a left-wing thing. And I've seen people in independent media, for example, be cancelled for not being sufficiently right-wing enough. So it happens whenever you get people having very similar moral and political views and who are perhaps insecure about those views and without having a explicit commitment to diversity of thought. I think when you have organisations which have an explicit commitment to pluralism and diversity of thought, then there's more likelihood that tolerance of dissenting viewpoints will occur. If there is no such explicit commitment, may as well just get rid of the people who are making trouble.
Anne, you want?
I take that one step further. We all think cancel culture is new. I maintain it's always been there.
It's not new at all.
No. Without going back to the Puritans, I can remember the ABC in the 60s and 70s where nobody got on who didn't agree with a certain line of left-wing thinking. Mm. You just never had been on to be cancelled. Editorials have done that for years too. How's social media made it more vicious? Because the sort of stuff that went on at the weekend with the whoever they were in the black shirts trying to make up a protest against a woman who happened to be opposed to transgender men being in women's sport, whatever, however we explain it. That became violent, angry. People in Parliament have been throwing around, you know, the word Nazi as if it was yesterday's milk. What's social media done to cancel culture to make it so nasty?
Well, you're right that cancel culture has always been around. I think... one thing that social media has done is that it's made us all... So depending on your social milieu, you may have to advertise your political or moral position in order to be accepted by your friends. So if you're an academic in academia and all of your colleagues are denouncing someone for being Nazi adjacent or whatever it is, and you are not seen by your colleagues as denouncing them, you might feel insecure about your position in the network. I think what social media has done is it's made, you know, there's only a small minority of people who are genuine cancelers, but it's the large group of onlookers who join in because they want to conform and they're cowardly. And social media has just made that elevated to another level.
We're getting close to the end now. Just tell us a bit about yourself, because you obviously haven't got a background on social media that's in any way disadvantageous to your current career. Unlike Toby Young in your book here, who was picked up for a bad joke he made 10 years ago and got kicked out of all these charitable organisations to which he belonged. So you study, you go into psychology. When did you first start writing?
It would have been 10 years ago in 2013.
In what?
I wrote for the Sydney Morning Herald first, just in a few op-eds, and I had my own blog, but I've never been a prolific writer. I've always liked curating other people's work. And I'm married to Harry, who's at the back, and I have two small children. So one reason why I'm not as prolific as I should be is because I have little children to look after.
Are they on social media?
No, they're not, thankfully.
I heard you had to go home to direct a TikTok production, but that must have been a vicious rumour. Okay, we're getting near the end now. Is anyone...
Is it here? Oh, it's got to be brief. Okay.
Thank you. Claire, apologies for being late. Jeremy Kinross. I think the internet has proliferated the tribalism of which you did speak and has cemented tribalism, made it worse, because people can find their niche. As an example, before I ask my question, Jared, is George Pell. I didn't see whether you addressed that or Jared in his introduction to you in your book. That cemented tribalism without fact. If people had looked at Mark Weinberg's decision and read factually, unlike some of the other judges, had not addressed them in detail like Weinberg's decision, which I think was recently mentioned in Spectator or Quadrant, then the facts would have led to the right result, inverted commas. So my question is, did you address that issue of George Pell in your book? And the use of Gerard's word was so right, excommunicated. I mean, he was so unjustly treated by the media. It was a disgrace. So could you comment on that issue, please?
We did publish an essay about that incident on Quillette, but it's not in the anthology.
No.
Yeah, but the person who wrote the essay for us argued that it was a miscarriage of justice, what happened. Hmm.
Do
you
have time for
Richard?
Yes, we do.
Very
brief.
That'd be very brief, Richard. Okay. Antonio Gramsci, The Long March Through the Institutions, and the objective of achieving communism in Western Europe will be done by doing just that. What do you think about that in the context of what we've been discussing this evening?
Well, I'm familiar with Gramsci, and I used to reference him years ago. I feel like... I think conservatives have a role to play in changing institutions from within, or at least attempting to, and if they can't, then starting their own institutions, which is what I've done. Not that I'm a traditional conservative, but I'm not a lefty progressive either. And I think at some point there's got to be initiative when it comes to either building something new or changing from within rather than complaint. Quibble or critique I have of the right is there's too much complaint, not enough action in building. And I think if there were more positive vision about building new institutions, you could probably get more young people to be excited about the future.
Many thanks. I think that was a great comment on which to end. There's a lot of pessimism around, and I think what we've found tonight is that Claire Lehman and the people who work with her in Quillette are essentially optimistic. They believe that things can get better, and a lot of the comments that were made earlier tonight about what's happened with your online magazine and other magazines and people willing to spend money to buy products produced in this kind of genre is very important. So I think tonight we've had a realistic and optimistic assessment with a bit of positivity, and we're very grateful for that. And as I said, we've got copies of the book, and I'm sure there'll be other publications.